Welcome to the BBC.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Between Both Cheeks. Today, we have a very special guest, Dai Manuel. He is an entrepreneur, a lifestyle business mentor, a high-performance coach, author, and a TEDx speaker. So welcome to our podcast. Thanks for doing this. You're so busy.
Luba, I stopped wearing that little badge that said, I'm so busy. I stopped wearing that, I guess, 14, 15 years ago. Because now when people say, man, you must be so busy. I'm like, I'm not busy. Actually, I'm far from busy, but my days are very full.
You know? I love that.
Yeah, I fill it with the stuff I want to fill it with, the people I get to fill it with, like you guys, right? So this is fantastic. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, I need to take a page out of that book because I'm always saying I'm busy. Yeah, okay, I love that. So, Dai, I don't know if you remember first meeting and where we first met.
Well, I'd like to say I've kept my hygiene going. Is that where you're going with that?
Okay, yeah.
Because I have to say, I'd never heard about anal bleaching before I met you. So, and I still tell this story occasionally. You know, I've been there. I've been down that path before, everybody, and it's not that bad. It's okay. It's okay. I didn't maintain the anal bleaching, but I am a bald dude from the neck down. So, I've never gone back.
So cool. So those of you wondering, I met Dai at Wax Hair Removal Bar in Vancouver when I first opened. So it had to be like 16 years ago because I was working the front desk. It was so, so long ago. But one thing I do really remember about you is that you just had a really great energy and a presence. And there was just something about you. And like we have seen tens and thousands of clients, but you were one of the few that really just stood out. And then, you know, social media kind of took over and I found you somehow and I messaged you and here we are today.
Full circle. It's all so cool. So cool. You opened my eyes to the world of waxing, you know, like it's, I gotta say, cause man, I could never go back after that. And you know, if there's any guys listening to this, I'm telling you. And I tell this to all my guy friends. Now they laugh at me, but I'm like, until you try it, you can't knock it. But man,
that's right.
My wife loves it too, by the way. So everybody wins on this one. But I just love it. It's just so clean, so freeing. Like there's nothing like feeling freshly waxed, especially between the cheeks, you know? So, but yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
So one of the things I want to get into, because I know once I introduced you, everyone's going to want to know about the TEDx talk. So tell us about that experience, what you talked about, and then let's dive into that.
Oh, well, you know, on my vision board for probably about 12 years, I had that I wanted to be on a TED stage. You know, like I'm someone that grew up with a lot of social anxiety. And occasional bouts of depression, my mental health's always been challenged. And it stems from, you know, in my childhood, my teen years, I was morbidly obese. And so there was a lot of sort of trauma back then, some experiences that were not positive. But I made some big changes at age 15. And by 17, you know, I had a new lifestyle, a new perspective on myself, at least externally. Internally, I didn't. You know, internally, I still felt like that morbidly obese fat kid, sort of felt like imposter syndrome, very dealing with a lot of anxiety, especially in big social settings. And then I was introduced to alcohol. And very quickly did I realize, wow, I got a couple drinks in me. This isn't that bad. You know, I can talk to anybody. I feel okay. Like, this is good, you know? And of course, when I started opening up a bit more and being a bit more outgoing with my energy, that was reciprocated back to me, confirming this belief that I had formed that people preferred the drinking version of me than the regular version.
Fun guy die.
That's right. That's how I open up the TED talk, you know, and it's just that, like that fun guy die persona perpetuated from age 17 to 32. So 15 years of my life. Now, during that time, I scaled a business to 10 figures a year. You know, went through some other professional changes, you know, in learning that with a team of people to build and scale to that size. And it was a lot of fun. And also at the same time was, you know, seeking accolades. I got to tell you, like that was what drove me. You know, I was looking for affirmations from others, this confirmation that I'm somebody of value. And so it drove me professionally, you know, seeking more titles, seeking more money, seeking more recognition, but never feeling satisfied. And so what do? You drink more, you know, to sort of avoid this bit of a chasm that was in my life and this gap, even though I was, you know, met my wife, we started having kids quite young, you know, navigating all these things that I always said was important to me, but I wasn't honoring 100%. You know, every opportunity to deviate from that path, I took it freely and believing that's what I had to do for other people to like me, you know? So, oh, my phone battery died tonight, Christy. Sorry. Oh, I didn't realize what time it was. Wow. Gosh, man, lost time. You know, that night at the bar, sure. Sheesh. Time just flies, you know, when you're drinking, you know, so this was a normal. And at age 32, she wasn't willing to have it as a normal thing anymore. And rightly so. Long and short of it, that TED Talk was all about, for once in my life, getting to a place where I could be vulnerable with somebody else, like truly vulnerable. And I know there's IT professionals that are listening. It's like, ah, vulnerability just means your system needs better, you know, protection, get McAfee or something like that. And I'm like, listen, man, vulnerability has lots of different meanings. But when you ask a man, what does vulnerability mean? There is a lot of stereotypes, a lot of cliches, and a lot of stigmas that are often referenced. You know, like real men don't cry, you know, being vulnerable, just sign of weakness. Real men don't get vulnerable. You know, like the only emotions that I was always modeled in my 20s, even in my teens and even in my early 30s, you know, what was modeled by the other men around me? It was like, yeah, you could talk shop. And if you're going to express an emotion, it could be occasionally laughter or yelling. Like that was sort of the two polar opposites, right? Like that was the common emotions that everyone was comfortable sharing. So you start to wonder, like, well, if that's all what we're modeling and being mentored to do, that's just normal. I'm fitting in with everybody else. Meanwhile, always feeling like there was a bit of a void, this lack of connection, especially as a father of two daughters. You know, I just like, yeah, am I representing what a man is and showing them this is what a man is, you know? And I realized I wasn't, you know, after my wife asked me a question. And we can get to that in a little bit, but that's what the talk was all about. Was this coming to a point in my life where I realized if I continued down the path that I was going down, everything that I believed I always was working towards, I was going to lose it all, you know, lose it all. And at my own volition, you know, nobody else was forcing me to take a drink. I was choosing to mute my phone. I was choosing to buy another round for everybody. Because if I bought everybody else a round, it meant I could have another drink too. You know, like it's just amazing the mind games, right? To justify these holes that we often feel in ourselves. And I got really good at that, you know, really good at that.
Wow.
Whew. Oh, but wait, I'll end it on a positive. My wife asked me a question while we were discussing getting a divorce. Yeah. What life would be like co-parenting. We'd been together for 10 years at this point, you know, when I was 32. So we got together when I was 22, you know, she was like 20 and we started having kids a few years together. So, you know, she sat me down. We're talking about what life's going to look like us going our separate ways, co-parenting our kids. And because this was not an environment she was willing to allow our daughters to grow up in any longer. And she was right to say that, you know, and at the time, the attitude that I had, I was pretty pissed off. I was very antagonistic. I felt on the defense, which, you know, I felt like, oh, you're attacking me, you know, da, da, da. Like, well, this is how I've been the last 10 years. And you want me to change now? You know, like just everything, trying to justify myself. And then she asked me a question. This is the question. So whether you're listening to this, you're watching this, or you just happen to come across this question somehow, I always invite people formulate it in the way that is relevant to your life and your situation. But my wife asked me, Di, are you being the type of man that you would want to marry your daughters? And I was like, oh, I felt like she kicked me in the nuts, punched me in the nose, and gutted me all at the same time. Like, honestly, it was just like, this moment where I was just like, I'm not being that guy, but I want to be that guy. And I made a choice right then and there, go 1 year without drinking. Now, I know people are like, 1 year, dude, that's not a big deal. Hey, man, from age 17 to 32, the longest I've ever done is like a sober January. That's it, once. Like, it was always present. So it was a big deal, me making that 1 year commitment. But I realized very quickly, 6 weeks into that journey, I'm fucked. You know, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to do it. I needed help. And that is when I got vulnerable with my wife for the first time in our 10-year relationship. I finally opened up with her and told her what I was feeling, what I was thinking, and what those little voices in my head were always screaming.
How did you get to that point? Was it with the help of a counselor? Was it the help of a book? I don't know too many men that just get there to be vulnerable.
I think it came out of necessity, if I'm perfectly honest. You know, I was more afraid of not opening up to this feeling. You know, I was more afraid of avoiding that, ignoring it, and trying to keep muscling my way through this period, you know, this 1 year, so to speak, that I committed to. But I learned very quickly in the first 6 weeks, not having alcohol presence, that normal activity that was there for business, for pleasure, and for me just killing time. Alcohol was always there. And this 6 weeks of not having it and saying no and having to tell my story and justify why am I not drinking, it was very overwhelming. And as soon as I had some down days, like hard days where my mental health was struggling, I wanted it more, you know, because it was my normal way of coping. And I realized very quickly, if I don't get some help, and this is what I sort of rationalized internally, I can't do this on my own. I realized I couldn't. I wouldn't be able to sustain this full year. And it was out of necessity with my wife one night on the couch. I just verbal diarrheaed all over her. It was just she held space for me though. I got to give it to her. She was such a generous listener. She just let me go and yammer on. It was the first time I told her about even my past, you know, being obese as a kid and some of the teasing and the ridicule and the bullying and just all that stuff that I'd been bundling up for so many years and avoiding ever acknowledging. And it was, I don't know how long it went. It could have been an hour. It could have been 30 minutes. I have no idea. I know at the end of it, she looked at me and she said, thank you. And she said, I hear you. It's going to be okay. I love you. And then she said, I think you need to talk to somebody, you know, so, full, 100% truth here, you know, and when she said that, I knew she was right. You know, I knew she was right, even though I had such a negative outlook on mental health, you know, practitioners and psychiatrists. I'm like, I'm not crazy. Why do I have to go to see a shrink? You know, I'm just being honest. That was my perspective. And I was very stereotypical in my belief system, you know, especially as a male that represents as a male and grew up in the 80s, you know, 90s. I had a lot of these beliefs and they were hardwired in. And I knew that they hadn't served me for those first 32 years. So maybe I need some new beliefs. And so that's what I did. She helped me find a good psychologist. I worked with him for about four and a half months, found a relationships counselor to help us with our communication. And first session on the couch, come to the end of that session, she's looking at Christy. She's looking at me. She's looking at Christy, looking at me. And she's like, Christy, I think it'd be better if Di came back on his own for a little bit. here we are for, you know, couples counseling. And she's like, yeah, Di's got to come back on his own. So I went back and saw her a few times and it really helped as well. But I decided I'm going to go all in with this stuff. That was it. I'm not willing to not be that man that I would be so proud of my daughters attracting a male like that in their life when they're older, you know, and I couldn't allow myself not to be that anymore. And I didn't know how I was going to get there. I mean, perfect transparency on this, but I knew I wanted to do it and I believed I could. Didn't know how long it was going to take and I didn't care. I just got to start doing things differently than I'd done it and not be afraid to ask for help. So I had to get vulnerable and it was uncomfortable and it's still uncomfortable today for me asking people for help. I still feel really uncomfortable. Full disclosure, you know, almost 15 years later, it's still it's not a natural thing for me. But I'm more open to it today and I'm less afraid of it. Let's say that.
I'm so curious on how the people that you chose to surround yourself before, where they are today, and how did that all look for you?
Well, a lot of my social connections back then were also work connections. I was working so much, a lot, you know, a 60-hour work week was a late week. And as such, you know, a lot of the people I was social with were also people I worked with, you know, just out of convenience and out of, well, comfort, to be honest. You know, it was just the normal thing for me. So we would hang out. And also, you know, being from an industry that's very, let's just say, male dominated, I come from a fitness industry. I was selling fitness equipment, accessories, that kind of stuff, in a retail environment. And, we just had a lot of men in our space, you know, and they were often younger than me too. So, you know, it's this sort of, it was just a tough place to be. You know, they were at different stages of life, but yet I was looking at them thinking, oh, I kind of want to be that guy still, you know, and not honoring the fact, I got a wife, I've got kids, you know, I've got responsibilities. I'm not that little boy anymore. I got to grow up here, you know? And so I realized also my association at the time weren't open to my changes. Like they weren't in a place where they wanted those kind of changes. So if I would be in that environment and being the sober version of myself, I was really craving deeper connection, trying to have different conversations because I wasn't drinking. You know, I wasn't drinking. I was, but I was still trying to be social at times and showing up there. But I realized very quickly, you know, the connection wasn't happening. You know, that alcohol was the common denominator that united us all. And now I take that away and I felt like I had excluded myself from connecting with them. But that wasn't the case. It was, they weren't ready to cross that bridge yet. And I can't make them, you know? And so I found a new association and it was hard, you know, like it is like trying to find a whole new social group, right? Especially when a lot of that social group is also your work friends. And it took some time. But you know, I feel very happy that to say, you know, my wife and I, we look to find new friends and new communities that alcohol wasn't a part of in order to support me. Because if I didn't have the crutch there or that little piece, it would be easier for me because also it's people that don't need to rely on that crutch for their level of connection. So I found Toastmasters. Wonderful organization, you know, and I went all in with that organization. I really did. I joined a few clubs. Like I found like, I'm going to get my social connection through this, but also I got to deal with my social anxiety piece. What better way? I'm going to go to a club that's focused on helping people become better communicators, public speakers, as well as working on leadership skills. So I was like, okay, this sounds like for me, you know, it's personal and professional development and there's no alcohol involved. Yay, I can do this. And it didn't take too long. I started to develop some really good relationships there.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
What is your, what's your relationship with alcohol today?
Oh, listen, we're no longer bedfellows. Let's say that. I've got no problem with alcohol. I've got friends, my wife drinks, you know, like I've got no issue with alcohol at all. The issue was with me. It wasn't the alcohol. Right. It was just that it was just a crutch. It was my easy way of, you know, confirmation bias is real, right? If you have a certain belief that you can't do something and yet you believe that there's something that can help you do that thing, you're going to constantly try to prove it to be true. And for me, that was alcohol. You know, I believed I couldn't connect with people without it. And all of a sudden, you know, after that first year, I started to realize, you know what? That's a lie. I can connect with people without alcohol, you know, and I actually like it. and it was always a choice for me. Like I didn't feel like, and this is where it gets a little confrontational in some conversations, because I do have a lot of friends that are in STEP programs. And they're very specific about, you know, the 12-step program, and it's done wonders for them. And I know it's helped a lot of people globally, and I'm not here to speak negative of it, but it wasn't a fit for me. It just wasn't, you know. But I didn't want to not move past alcohol, but I had to do a lot of inner work to do that, you know. And so there's other ways of working your way through this, because I never felt like alcohol was forcing me. I never felt like I was out of control where – like this is the thing, you in 12-step programs, you have not only admit that you have a problem, but also admit that the problem will always be with you. You know, like there's a very astute label, you know, once an addict, always an addict. So it's constantly choosing to go the other direction. And I was like, I don't want to own that label. I don't feel like I was ever addicted. I was ever drinking because I had to drink. I drank because I wanted to drink and I chose to drink, you know? And, but it was really me just trying to avoid a lot of stuff. And that's what I did. You know, I was avoiding and also looking for deeper connection. But meanwhile, the alcohol has actually taken me away from deeper connection, which is so funny, right? When you really look at it, that's the oxymoron of the whole thing, is that as much as I thought it was actually allowing me to connect with more people, it was actually allowing me to amass a lot of connections, but never feeling connected.
So where did Bali happen? Like, where was that timeline?
Well, let me say this to everybody who's thinking about change, right? Like, and I think we're all somewhat change averse. Like, let's be honest, change is not usually easy. But usually when we endure big periods of change, especially if it's a challenging change, we usually come out the other end thinking we feel better for it, right? We feel like it was worth it. Like, I was worth it. I was worth that change, you know? And the thing is, when I moved away from alcohol and I started opening up all this space to start to really not only introspect and reflect, but actually set some very, very clear intentions about the kind of life that I want to be leading, I started to realize the path that I was on professionally wasn't going to align with the goal that I wanted. And one of the goals that I wanted was to be able to spend more time with my family and experience more experiences in life rather than constantly looking to collect stuff, you know, like, because we amassed a lot of stuff. You know, my wife, we had dual incomes, you know, we had these young kids, kids aren't cheap, but we had the toys, we had the home, we had the vehicles. Like, we, outside looking in, everyone's like, wow, they got it together. Meanwhile, it's like, if you only knew, right? And well, long and short of it, after I moved away from alcohol, those first couple of years, I realized my path I was on at the former company I co-founded wasn't what I wanted anymore. That's very scary to come to that realization, because I was like, man, I've been here like almost 17 years. I thought this is where I'd be the rest of my life. I thought this is it. And then you realize it's not it. In fact, what I think I want is over here, but that's going to involve a complete change. Thankfully, my wife was awesome and very open to the idea of that change and was very supportive of that and helped us navigate it to the point when I left my career 17 years. A month after that, she left hers. 2 months after that, we pulled the kids out of school, gave away our stuff, packed up the SUV and started traveling. And over that 5-year period, we went all over North America and eventually ended up overseas, going to Bali for just 3 months to experience, you know, Southeast Asia as a family. And then after 3 months, we're like, you know, do we have to leave? I think we could stay here for a bit. You know, 2.5 years later, we eventually moved back to Canada. But so that's so what sort of brought
us. You stayed in Bali for that long?
2.5 years. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was pretty wild.
I have a question. So you said like what you felt would earlier in the conversation, you said what normal felt like, even, you know, after all these changes, you still felt the void. So when or if, I want to know, did that void go away? What does that look like now?
Yeah. I guess, you know, we all have to sort of ask ourselves.
Because you've made a lot of changes.
Yeah. Look, tons of changes, you know, professionally and personally.
It looks like every 15 years, I'm like trying to write a timeline. And it's like seriously, every 15 right? years. Yeah.
Exactly. Age 15, yeah. Then again, 32. And then eventually again in my early 40s, you know, and yeah. Some were health changes. You know, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition about 10 years ago. So that definitely influenced some of my health direction and just how I looked at health. But when I gave up alcohol, things became very clear that there were some things that we wanted to achieve in our life. And one thing that my wife had always wanted, and she never skirted around this, you know, she was never mixing words. She was always very straight, that she wanted to travel as a family at some point. So deep down, I always wanted to honor that, not knowing how we would do that. And I guess, you know, if I get back to your actual question there, you know, when I think back on it, you know, change is hard because we have to take into account not only the things around us change, but we ourselves change. And it's often our perspective is most of all. But it's very intimidating, right? Change, like it can be. And I guess, you know, for us, it was just, we knew if we started to go down that path, we would ask ourselves, what's the worst that could happen? And the worst that could happen is that we're both very employable, that we'd move back to Canada and get a job. We have friends that love us, family that loves us. They have spare bedrooms. They have couches. They have big backyards we can pitch a tent in. You know, like, it's like, we're all good. We'll be okay. But those people around us were quite negative at times. You know, I remember getting a Facebook message saying, you know, you're taking your kids out of school. What? Like, this is a form of child abuse. I couldn't believe it. Like, that's almost verbatim, the message, you know? And I was like, well, unfriend, block. Okay, moving on. But literally, it was like that kind of response. I was just like, I was so surprised that this person that I knew personally was so close-minded, you know, and didn't even entertain the idea of wanting to listen to our motivations for why we were doing this. But anyway, sorry, Aaron, what was your actual question? I think I sort of skirted around. I was getting to a point there, and I think I freaking forgot where I was going with that. So
Okay. So you talked earlier in the conversation, you talked about even when what normal was, you still felt this void, right? So at what point, or if ever at all, did that go away? Because what I'm collecting, right, your 15 years of change, every 15 years is a big change. And honestly, it sounds like you start to perk up and your happiness comes through when you talk more so about being selfless instead of selfish, like early on.
Well, Aaron, to be honest, you know, normal is constantly challenged, I think is probably the easiest way to say it. From the standpoint, anytime we get to a place where we feel like things are getting too normal, my wife is very good at change. You know, she's very resilient to change. And I've learned a lot because of that. And it's still for me, I'm a slow traveler, full disclosure. Like I don't mind traveling, but I like staying in places for extended periods. You know, I like to experience it. And also it's the actual getting to and from locations I really don't enjoy. Okay, I don't like getting crammed into a seat, lugging a bunch of bags, waiting in lineups to get on a plane, you know, like just going through security. Like I don't enjoy the actual travel portion as much as everyone says, enjoy the journey, right? I'm like, if I could skip over the journey and just get to the destination, I would when it comes to travel, okay? And my wife, she loves every aspect of it. And this has not prevented us from moving forward. And why I'm sharing this as an example is my new normal now is I'm okay with feeling uncomfortable for certain periods of time, because I also realize it's a moment, right? It's not a permanent situation. And I think I have to constantly remind myself of what I've come through and what I've worked through. And I didn't do it alone. You know, there was always somebody there that could support me when I would ask for help, when I got open to asking for help. But even at times, you know, there's been people around me that were wonderful models, you know, modeling a lifestyle or a life that I myself wanted. And it was really just me trying to get out of my own way to say, you know what? They can do it. Why can't I? And when we acknowledge that, we have to say, well, what's going to prevent me or hold me back from actually doing that? And I think that's where the crutches come into place, right? That's where these little gaps in not only our knowledge, but also in just how we do stuff, you know? And so for me, is the gap gone? I like to say the gap that was there is gone. You know, as you go down this path, there's going to be new gaps that are exposed. As an example, you know, like financially, when I exited my company, I didn't exit at a good time. We were in a down market. It's not like I made up with enough to like, oh, we're great. You know, we won't have to make any money. Nuh-uh. Like, you know, within that first 6 months of traveling, I remember us running out of money. You know, I'm like, holy shit, what are we going to do? You know, but I had started doing my own businesses online, and I knew there'd be a period of time there before I would monetize that. So it was just trusting that that would happen before we ran out of savings, right? And didn't want to skip, you know, dip into the cool skids, the school fund for the kids and all that stuff, right? Lo and behold, my wife was always the person to say, you know what? When we need it, it'll happen. And I'm always like, you know what? That blind positive thinking. Brr. I always joke, my wife's sick with PMA. Positive mental attitude, right? Like she's like, it's chronic condition with her, you know? But I'm like, hey, if there's a pandemic and it's PMA, I think we all want to catch it, you know? And she's a good example. She always said it will happen. And sure enough, that 6 months, it was like within a couple of days of us, like, if we don't get something in right now, I'm going to have to call somebody to lend us some money, a little bit of bridge financing here, you know? And sure enough, a couple new clients came in, you know? And I was like, whoa, okay, we're good now, you know? And I think I'm trying to adopt that as my new normal, is allowing things just to happen. Of course, there's intention. You still got to do certain actions. And it's not being blindly optimistic that if I do the thing, then I will get this result. But you have to trust that the process will bring you closer to the goal.
So like manifestation,
I believe so. You know, like, again, I appreciate Byrne's work, you know, the Secret, right? I think it's a very good read. But if we look at psychology's way of sort of validating that, there's something called the reticular activation system. You know, this is a part of the brain that really taps into our subconscious, where, you know, our subconscious starts to recognize things that we've consciously acknowledged that we want. And what I mean by that is one of the most famous examples that sort of describes it is like, just imagine someone says to you, yeah, or you decide one day, I want a pink Cadillac. I don't know, maybe join Mary Kay, right? I want to work for that pink Cadillac, right? But all of a sudden you start noticing pink Cadillacs on the street, right? And it's like, well, they were always there. You just, for some reason, you weren't recognizing or noticing them. Is that manifestation? Well, yeah, in a way it is, you know, like our subconscious starts to become this running program in the background that is trying to say, hey, yo, brain, conscious self, there's that thing you said you were interested in, you know, this goal that you have for your life, that significant partner that you're hoping to meet one day, you know, like that new career path. Well, hey, do you hear that conversation happening at the coffee table next to you? Oh, I think that guy's involved in the media industry. You know, you said you want to get into media. Why don't you just go be brave? Be bold, go say hello, right? Like, because for some reason that aligned on that day at that moment, right? And, you know, we can call this divine intervention. We can call it maybe a miracle. You know, we can call it manifestation. I don't know what you want to call it, but I think it is really just that opening up to the possibility that it can happen and be ready when it does.
We work in an industry that is, beauty. You know, it's consumed by women, it's fueled by women, but it's run by men.
Isn't that interesting? That's so
and,
interesting.
And this is something that I've dealt with like my entire career. And I just feel like there's like this missing connection of the emotion, because cosmetics is driven by emotion. I mean, lipstick sales went up 411% after 9/11.
Really? Wait, yes. Wait, why is that though? Can I ask why?
Why like, do you why think? Wait, why do you think?
Yeah, here we go. Okay.
See if you can...
Honestly, I have no idea.
Same in recessions.
After 9/11, I didn't feel like I got to go get some lipstick. I mean, I didn't think of that, right? Sorry, what was that, Becca?
Same in recessions. Beauty sales go up as well.
I mean, even the pandemic, like it was in, we had sold out, I think, 4 times online in the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Everyone was bleaching their butthole.
Dang, that's why I couldn't get any. Okay.
Yeah. And it's cross industry too. It's not just Bright. These are statistics that even in recessions,
interesting.
Kitchen products and beauty products increase.
Wow. Well, that's fascinating. I didn't realize that.
Well, you said earlier, like you're a child of the 80s and 90s, and you know, the examples that you had around you were to, you know, either be angry or laugh occasionally. Mm. And for women, they say like, you know, put on lipstick or put your big girl panties on. So it's similar, but it's polar opposite for us women.
Wash your face.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think it just comes from a place of like, it's a very inexpensive way to make yourself feel better instantly, right? Like I wore lipstick when I went. Well, it depends, right? But like someone could come in and buy a $4, $5. I'm aging myself. This is when I was a counter girl, but someone could come in and buy a $4.99 Maybelline lipstick and put it on and feel good about themselves for a little bit, right? It was the same thing, like advice that I was given when I was going through chemo is put on lipstick.
I put lipstick on for this podcast.
Right. It's just like a feel good moment. But going back to you know, my topic that I wanted to discuss is I've always felt that it being run by men, that there is a missing connection of the emotional side of cosmetics. And it brings me to wanting to have the conversation about your mentorship Mondays. Well, I'm just going to leave it with you because
okay.
Because I would like to send some of these cosmetic men to your mentorship Mondays.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think there's what I've noticed. Okay. And listen, since the Me Too movement became so prominent, I think there's been a lot more men that have been in the sort of the flanks, you know, off to the sidelines, observing what's going on, not really taking sides. Like they're not pro. They're not con. So you know what I mean? Like they're just trying to be neutral. And I don't think it's, you know, as a father of two girls, I ain't going to be neutral. So what I think we're seeing more of now, and what I was trying to bring up with the Me Too movement is, you know, that is the first time we really saw social media, like a movement explode from social, right? And then it went offline, and thankfully, and we're still seeing the repercussions of some of those actions that have been implemented, and we're seeing people being brought forward and being charged accordingly, the Epsteins of the world, right? The Harvey Weinsteins, like these guys, like they're being held accountable. And I think it's wonderful. You know, it makes me very happy as a father of two girls to know that the world is going that direction, but there's still a lot of gaps, a lot of gaps. And I believe that a lot of those gaps are due to men, but I think men don't want to be the problem. They want to be helpful. They want to be part of the solution, especially men that are more open to exploring some of those other sides that make us whole. Some of those emotional pieces of us. And as I said in my TEDx talk, you know, we're not humans that choose to be emotional. We're emotional humans. You know, like that's just who we are. It's in our DNA. We're sentient beings. We feel stuff, you know? And so avoiding that and trying to, you know, suppress some of those things, it ain't healthy. All right. Like I look at all the wars in the world, right? You look at all the drama in the world. You're right. There's a man at the head of every table. And it's like, hello, maybe we need to make some changes here. Who's at the table? And I got no problem. I'll step back. I'll give my daughters the keys to the kingdom. Here you go, girls. Go for a drive. Because I think they'll still do a better job than most of the men out there. You know, now maybe I'm being a bit facetious, blindly optimistic, maybe. But big changes call for big changes, you know, big shifts. Like, and so I guess with this whole men's perspective sort of scenario, there's a lot of men out there that are open to this conversation. They're open. They do believe that there's something called toxic masculinity. They may themselves may have been a victim of it. It's not just women that are feeling that. There's also men. I remember when I shared my post, my TEDx talk, one of the first shares I did on LinkedIn, there was a gentleman from Australia that chirped in. And he said, you know, vulnerability is a weakness for men.
Wow.
Now, the funny thing was, there was a bunch of other women that came to the defense after. It was women that came to the defense, right? Saying, no,
this they is what came after him for you.
Yeah, and they commented, right? And but I also remember I put a poll out when I was doing my research to get some of the statistics that I shared. You know, some of them were already ones that were done by the Movember Project, especially a huge UK poll that they did that talked about, you know, as men age, they actually have fewer, deeper connections, fewer friends. And like so much so that, you know, they couldn't even count on one hand how many close people they could have a serious conversation with that would often talk about, you know, finances, relationships, maybe careers, you know, just that depth of it wasn't there, that comfort level, I guess, you know, to have that conversation with another man wasn't existing. And that's a startling stat. And I remember I put out a poll on Facebook and I got about 100 responses on it. You know, people that filled out the survey, just asking the perspective. But I invited men and women to fill out the survey. You know, and one of the things is, what is a great man? And what do you think about vulnerability in a man? And I got to tell you, some of the women saw it as a negative. And they were very clear on voicing that as well. Like they thought that that's not what they want in a man. They don't want vulnerability. And it made me start wondering, well, how do we all define vulnerability? And I think that's where the challenge may be, is that we have different ideas or different relationships or experiences with that term. And as such, that influences how we react or act accordingly with this whole conversation. So as a guy that wants to have more of these conversations, I put out when I was living in Bali, I was like, hey, is there any other guys out there that would like to connect once a week, you know, over dinner and conversation and just talk about this idea of what makes a great man? And the crazy thing was, I had one guy that was already doing men's circles up in Ubud, which is sort of the interior part of Bali. It was about an hour north of where I was living. I was living down in Canggu, which is sort of the surf side of Bali. And I remember reaching out to him saying, hey, this is what I got, this idea. This is what I'm going to start. Would you be open? He's like, I'll come down once a week and help you with it. I was like, wow, Nick, thank you. My buddy Nick Wood. And he continues to run some of the online ones, you know, and this is just it. We had a bunch of men start saying, I want this. And not only do they want it, they kept coming back week after week after week, to the point that we'd have a couple dozen guys aging from 18 to 70 sitting around a big dinner table once a week, just talking about what's alive and real for them. Talking about the good, talking about the great, talking about the, oh gosh, I can't believe I'm telling this to another person, you know, like, And it was completely cathartic, but also at the same time, we all felt more connected and elevated. So there's something to this. And I think that's also why we're seeing a lot more men's organizations pop up that aren't afraid of talking about the emotions, talking about this other half, this other dynamic that makes us human. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I really do. I do. I think it's great. But we're still a very small niche in a big ocean, right? And so I think it'll take time. You know, it'll take time. But yeah, I continue to run those, and looking forward to launching an in-person one here in Vancouver again.
Oh, great.
I started pre-pandemic, but what happened was the pandemic happened and everything just sort of fell off. We're going to reinitiate it though later this fall.
Our mentorship Mondays, do they happen without alcohol as well?
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. No alcohol, no drugs, mm-hmm. and no drama. We're very clear on that.
Yeah.
You know, there shouldn't be anything that influences you. If that is something that you want, this won't be the place to get it.
Yeah. No, I think that's good, because sitting around having dinner and conversation so often includes alcohol as a part of the conversation. And to what you were speaking about earlier, when you were working with fitness and with younger men who were still in their party era, and those were who you were surrounded by, so then you stayed in your party era. I feel like as adults, it's hard to find connection without alcohol, because so many of our social events include or are based around the consumption of alcohol. So it's really cool what you're doing with that, for not to include alcohol, even for those who are not sober, maybe just sober curious, or still do consume alcohol. Because really, are we really connecting if it is over beers? You know what I mean?
I do. And I witnessed it before, you know, started up with these men's groups, you know, and I think that was the thing that during that first year of change for myself, when I said, you know, I'm going to go a year with no drinking. And I realized that a lot of those conversations were really surfaced. But the funny thing was, I just became aware of that. They've always been the same way. It's not like things had changed all of a sudden. It's just all of a sudden I realized, oh boy, you know, I think I've been missing out on something here, you know, missing out on an opportunity to really get to know some people. But sometimes you got to go through that to figure it out, right?
Yeah. My boyfriend did a year sober, very similar to you. Yeah, he didn't have a problem, but he just wanted to try it. He's very into personal development. And he said the biggest lesson that he learned doing that was he got so used to saying no. And it really taught him how to say, not that he had a problem necessarily with saying no to alcohol before, but in all areas of life, right? It's like exposure therapy. You get so used to being like, no, I don't want to attend that event, or I need to go to bed now. Like, clock struck midnight, I'm turning into a pumpkin, I gotta go. Where I think it's so cool that, I mean, I haven't done it yet, so who am I to speak, but... One day, I think it would not only teach you about your relationship with alcohol, but so many other things about yourself personally, as you've done and as my boyfriend Dylan has done too.
I think it's great. You know, I think it's great. And after a year, you know, I honestly contemplated for a brief second that I might drink again. You know, my wife and I talked about it. She was sort of asking me questions to see, like, what was my goal as the year was coming to a close, you know, like, what was I thinking? And I just remember looking at Christy and saying, you know what? So much has changed in this last year, and I'm so grateful for that. What do you think would happen if I kept going?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I just kept going, you know, like, it's not like I have any fear around alcohol. I have any concerns with alcohol. None of that even exists. It's just, I just have no need and no want, you know? So that, and that's it. Like, I'm not here to vilify alcohol by any means as well. You know, like, I got no issue with alcohol.
You know, when we do our trade shows, one of my hard and fast rules is the entire team is not allowed to drink until the show is done. So every morning is morning meditation, meetings, share circle, no alcohol for the entire weekend until it's done. Because my experience with trade show life was it was fueled around alcohol. You don't make the best decisions, myself included. You wake up to regret. You make you know, bad decisions in business, and just like people are showing up hungover. And we see it with the other booths that are there of the people that go out. People don't show up for work. You can tell that they're hungover. And we tell the staff, like, no, like, the, if you want to be part of the Bright team, this is our culture. This is the brand. This is who we are. And when you walk that show, you can tell who wants to be there. Like, our energy and our vibe is so different. Do I like to have a drink? Absolutely. But for that moment, it is so important to be so present and honest and vulnerable with yourself and your team to make things go so smoothly, and then celebrate at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not when you have to wake up at 5 a.m.
Yeah, right.
Even one or two glasses, you cannot wake up at 5 a.m. and do your makeup and your hair. You got to look fresh.
And then work for 10 hours and repeat yourself over and over and over again. And have energy to hear all the time. I could.
Yeah, I love that culture that you create, though, and foster. And I think that's a wonderful example of just what's possible. You know, when you prioritize certain values and you set the intention for a culture, but then you lead by example, right? Like, that's the thing. We can talk about it all day long, but it's when we start acting as, that's when the actual, you know, things manifest, right? And so I admire that very much. I think that's great.
Thank you. So going back, if someone wants to join Mentorship Mondays, what does that look like? And I know there's one other rule that you didn't talk about. Fight Club rule stuff.
That's right. Whatever happens Vegas at Mentorship Monday stays at Mentorship Monday. Yeah, it is literally Vegas rules. It's we encourage men to come, be open. They can talk about anything while they're there. But when we leave, you can't talk about anybody else's experience, only your own. And what I mean by that is we can talk. We can say, yeah, I was at Mentorship Mondays, and this is what I talked about. You know, you can refer to your own story. That's fine. That's your story to tell if you want. But you can't share other people's experiences and what they're sharing, you know. And so we want to honor that, because there has been moments where men have shared things that they've never shared with another person in their entire life. And all of a sudden they're sharing it around a group of 20 guys. It's like, it is cathartic, but for that individual, you can tell this is one of the hardest things they've ever done. But when you see the lightness and just the camaraderie and support that's offered after such a share, especially when you get three or four other guys around the table putting up their hand. And when we do this gesture, it's like, I get you, me too. We don't say it, but this insinuates, it's an action that we have. We have all these hand gestures, so we don't interrupt other men when they're sharing. But this is like, me too. I get it. I've been there. Maybe I'm there right now, but I can relate to what you're sharing. You know, and it's powerful, because all of a sudden you think, man, I thought I was the only one that had this issue. I didn't think anybody would understand me. Meanwhile, oh my God, there's three or four other guys that all have dealing with the same. Maybe I should have opened up about this before. Because this is where the mentorship opportunities arise, right? Is we start to see, well, what have people been doing to sort of work through that? How do they work through it? Can they help this other person that's working through it? Maybe they can help each other. And it's like, it's incredible to see these things facilitated just because we decided to open up a little bit. But also on the flip side, we also share about the things that are going really well for ourselves. And this is one thing I've noticed in men. We feel that often if we're talking about the good things or wanting to celebrate some things that are happening that are really positive in our lives, and we share it with other men, we're afraid of being perceived as someone that's bragging or as someone that's just very self-indulged, right? Like, but meanwhile, it's like, I want to share about what's going on great in my life. And here, this men around this table, they want to celebrate that and acknowledge it and see it as well. And that's not an everyday thing for men. I can honestly say this because it's how I used to feel all the time. You know, I'd be like, I'd have a great thing that happened, but I'd feel like I can't tell it to the other guys because they're going to think I'm bragging about something. But if they're your real friends, they want to see you succeed.
Now, is this only in BC that you do this?
No. So Nick's still running three online ones. So we have one that's in the UK. So it's all over Zoom right now currently. So there's one in the UK time zone, one in the Eastern time zone, one in the Pacific time zone. And it's typically 7 p.m. in each of those respective time zones on Monday nights. I have a link in my Instagram that will direct you to that, or there's some links on my website as well. But the ones that I'll be initiating again will be an in-person one here in Vancouver. And that, I always say, the easiest way for people to get involved, if you're a man or you know a man that you think they need to learn about this, just connect them with me on socials, have them send me a message, and I will keep them in the loop of when we get going again. I've already set up an event meetup page on meetup.com. And so that will sort of be that first wave until my new website goes live, and then we'll sort of transition it to that. But for now, that's sort of the means that we'll be using. And I'm aiming for November to have our first get together again. So that'll be coming up soon enough, you know?
So Becca will grab all the links from you, and she'll put them in the show notes so you guys can click and share and do all of those things. I know we're coming up on our time. We definitely went over time, but I knew we were going to do it. I knew this was going to be so good. But what last words of advice, what are you working on next that people could be focused on?
Well, thank you. You know, I got a few things. I got a new version of my website, which I was supposed to be live last month, but developers taking a little longer. So that'll be out when it's out. But along with that will be a whole community section, which is free to join. It's where I just share a lot of information for people looking to make changes. And it's just literally a community of people to connect people with each other. So I'm really excited about that going live. That's something that should be coming down hopefully in the next sort of 4 to 6 weeks. And then outside of that, you know, I'm excited to really just start connecting with people in real life again, you know, and I know it's sort of funny to say that because we've been out of this pandemic, or at least as we knew it, for a while, but I found myself just, I don't know, avoiding being overly social or making new connections. And I don't know if that was a bit of a hangover from the pandemic, you know, dealing with my own stuff, having my daughter's transition off to university. I can give lots of excuses, but I felt like I needed to take some time for me. And I am excited about getting back out there again and meeting people in real life again, you know, and just connecting with great people. And so that's something that I'm really looking forward to. And I'll continue to push on with that as we lead into the fall and eventually into 2024.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us again. Again, we're going to put all your links and how to follow and how to attend all these things. So don't worry, everything will be there. Thanks again for taking the time. This was so great.
I was going to say thank you all for this opportunity, but also for just creating a platform that can capture these little conversations and make it public for everybody else to just absorb and recognize that there are different ways, you know, because we all learn through mentorship and modeling. And this is a great platform where you're showing both, you know, and having these great conversations and cataloging and capturing and sharing. So thank you three for doing this. I know it takes a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of energy, but man, pretty amazing. And so thank you for the opportunity to be here today.